facts in this disciplinary case are straightforward and without excuse. Those facts are that David Rossi, the respondent, is a young single practitioner who undertook the representation of a legatee in a pending state, that as a result of that representation, he enhanced the integrity of the probate court and its process by forcing the revelation of concealed assets by the executor, Mary Talini, so that the inventory was amended from $105,000 to $160,000. In the process, he recouped a recovery for his client that was almost three times what he would have had under the original filed inventory. Yet, for this conduct, Attorney Rossi has been made to suffer charges of disciplinary rule violation. Why? Because the complainant, Mary Talini, filed a grievance with the Cleveland Bar Association. This complainant was the person who had indeed hid the assets of the estate, had to indeed give up part of her inheritance to Mr. Rossi's client. After investigation, the later Cleveland Bar saw fit to file a complaint charging Attorney Rossi with violations of three rules. DR-7-104A, charging the direct contact of a represented party. DR-7-102, of filing unwarranted claims with a court. And DR-1-102, that his conduct was prejudicial to the administration of justice. The panel who heard this case on May 7th found all violations charged to be without grounds, except for one, that is, the contact of the adverse party, Mary Talini. We stand before you today to respectfully submit that in view of the panel's own findings of fact, that their conclusion is unfounded and unsupported, and at best should be construed as a technical violation of the disciplinary rule without the imposition of sanctions. Your Honors, the report, the findings of fact and conclusions of law, state the totality of the panel's findings of fact with respect to this issue of the contact of the party, Mary Talini. They are contained on page 6 and 7 of that report. They are as follows: that between December 2, 91 and December 9, 91, Russell Militia retained the respondent to represent his interests. Then Mr. Militia provided respondents with an inventory and voiced a concern for severe undervaluing of the estate assets, including bank accounts, which Mr. Militia said still existed. That pursuant to the probate code, objections to the inventory had to be filed within 30 days from the finding of the original inventory.
With those facts being all clear and we've read those, do you have any insight as to why the relator hasn't filed a brief and is not here?
I do not. With those facts and with the additional facts that the panel specifically found that the respondent, Attorney Rossi, made numerous efforts to contact the attorney representing Mrs. Talini, and the fact that that attorney was a full-time prosecutor and a part-time civil practitioner, the fact that he had moved his office, the fact that he had left messages with that attorney's secretary, the fact that his number, this attorney's number, had been disconnected, with those findings of fact, The panel also found that there had been no court proceeding whereby this attorney, Mr. Rossi, could raise his objection, and finding that the period between December 2nd and 30 days following involved the holiday period, so that he was under a severe time limitation. Nonetheless, found that he violated Disciplinary Rule 7104. There is no question that it was admitted that Mr. Rossi called Mrs. Galeen. The undisputed facts were that he called her in order to locate her attorney so that he could take the necessary steps that he needed to take in that restaurant.
Seems like it's related to what we do have here, that the conversation with her by him was maybe a little heated at some point or other. You suppose that's what they were looking at more than the direct contact?
I think they were, Your Honor, but I believe that under the circumstances, the rule, we must look at the purpose of the rule. And the rule says that an attorney shall not contact a party that is represented by counsel regarding the subject of the representation. And Mr. Rossi was not contacting her in regarding the substance, the merits of the representation. It was Mrs. Fellini who commenced the dialogue of calling Mr. Rossi disparaging names by virtue of his representation and vented her hatred for Mr. Rossi's client. Your Honors, we say to you that the injustice is further compounded in this case, that even assuming arguendo that this technical violation of a disciplinary rule should require some kind of sanction, by God, a sanction of suspension is excessive. It misses the mark and is totally without precedent. Why is it excessive? Suspension, regardless of whether it is imposed or suspended, carries with it the stigma that for a certain period of time, a person's conduct has been so unethical, so serious, that in essence, we find him or her unfit to practice law for a certain period of time. It is excessive also because it is unrelated to the alleged damage that is done. We all agree that a sanction should be reasonable. We all know that men and women can differ on what is reasonable. But we all agree that it ought to fit the crime, so to speak, it ought to fit the damage that was done to the complainant. In this particular case, the complainant was not just, as the panel specifically found, not just any other civil client. She was an executrix of an estate and thus held a fiduciary role and responsibility and as an officer of the court. She was the vice president of sales at the bank where she failed to reveal bank accounts at. She was a sophisticated lady who had gone through a prior estate dispute. Under those circumstances,
aren't some of our rules, and this might be one, a rule that the bar lives by, which is that we don't contact other folks' clients. If we found that rule we'd only look at violations of that rule with regard to what damage was actually done by that contact, I dare say the rule might be fairly toothless. Is it possible that we should have some rules that we look to as being, such a code by which it has to work, that lawyers have to abide by that so that clients aren't assessing in the meeting? They're in a terrible position where they're represented and someone else phones them and talks about their case and tells them their lawyer might not be doing the job. I mean, none of us could practice in that sort of scenario, could we?
We could not. Justice Cook, your point is well taken. I address my objection here to the severity of the sanction that has been recommended, to the severity of that sanction being suspension. It is in that context that I believe the issue of damage or what harm has been committed is relevant. it is also suspension itself. And that's the reason I'm here before this body this morning on behalf of this attorney, carries serious consequences throughout one's professional career. Every time an attorney applies for membership in a professional organization, the question is asked, have you ever been suspended from the practice of law? Every time an attorney files an application for legal malpractice insurance, the question is asked, have you ever been suspended from the practice of law? And a positive answer to that question often results in prima facie denial of membership, or prima facie denial of coverage, or indeed the raising of a different standard for coverage that would not otherwise exist. It is simply a severe sanction that ought to be applied with consideration to the conduct and any damage done. It is also excessive in this particular case, I respectfully submit, particularly in view of Justice Douglas's question, because it misses the mark. The recommended sanction ought to fit the violation. This violation being the contact of a party who's been represented.
One other thing, though, counsel, that seems to bear on the level of the sanction is the finding by the panel that respondent made false representations to the Certified Grievance Committee during its investigation and was less than candid in his testimony regarding his telephone contact and his subsequent litigation tactics.
It is precisely in this context that I address this issue to you now. Yes, the panel simply found a violation of 7104A and didn't even make a finding regarding the subject of the communication. Regardless of the allegations of the complaint, we're here on matters that have been found by evidence, not charges, what was found by evidence. In their findings of fact, they didn't even find the subject of the communication. Yet, they make the statement, and that is precisely what I believe, Justice Douglas, that this sanction recommended is motivated not by the violation of the rule regarding contact of an adverse client, but rather by the observation of the panel that Mr. Rossi was, quote, less than candid in the investigating stage with the grievance committee and less than candid in his testimony.
What do they mean by less than candid?
They mean exactly what you and I might think they would mean, Justice Sweeney. I can only tell you this, that we are lawyers and judges, that this panel was composed of a Supreme Court justice, retired, and two lawyers, that we are duty-bound to make findings of facts and evidence. This man, Mr. Rossi, was never charged with failure to cooperate in the disciplinary process. If he failed, if he had acted improperly, why wasn't he charged with a violation of that disciplinary rule? Yet, I believe that this panel took this sanction of suspension by way of shotgun to cover their observation. Is this man to be tried by innuendos and observation of unideal conduct that has not been raised to the level of a violation? I think that's unfair. I think he has the right to be faced with specific charges, has the right to face those as we face them at the hearing and introduce evidence on that issue.
Well,
so that's what I believe happened.
He faced charges, but then they say he made false representations. There's actually two things. False representations is stronger, and then less than candid. And that's in response to the charges. Should the panel not take that into consideration? We tend to take it into consideration as a mitigating factor. Should we not consider it when it's negative behavior?
Your Honor, as you have discerned by the review of this tortious history and cantankerous relationship, there were all kinds of facts in this matter that are extraneous indeed to the situation. And one of the extraneous matters was this young attorney's relationship with the investigating attorney for the Cleveland Bob. This young attorney was naive. He didn't get along with this man. There wasn't a rapport. He was unrepresented during that time and perhaps acted inappropriately. But I say to this body, even if that's the case, the man should be charged with a violation of something. We should not, what I'm saying is, we should not impose one sanction for a violation and another sanction for a violation and some inappropriate activity out here that it doesn't raise itself to the level of the violation of the disciplinary rule.
Every time we have a violation, which is proven or acknowledged, when we get to the imposition of a sanction, when the person has had an alcohol problem, has recovered from that, everything else about their life comes into play. I too am puzzled by that language about his lack of forthrightness and lack of cooperation. I'm not sure that I can find specifically what they're talking about. But another issue that was in here is this amended complaint that he filed against this woman, her employer.
But it was unequivocally found to be without basis, that in fact he had ample basis, and in fact it was proven to be the fact that his filing of the complaint resulted in the executrix revealing assets that had not yet been revealed, and assets that included bank accounts at the bank where she was an officer of sale. Your point, Justice Viper, is well taken.
Well, item 37, the respondent indicated in telephone conversations with Attorney Willacy that he had no legitimate good faith factual basis for such allegations.
Your Honor, that's an allegation. That's an allegation in the report. That is not a finding of fact. There are many allegations regarding Mrs. Colleen's accusations, et cetera, et cetera. There are many allegations, but what we must be, and that is my point here, we must be concerned with the findings of fact. Your point is well taken regarding the relevancy of extenuating circumstances or surrounding circumstances at the penalty imposition stage. With that, I agree, sir, except that when we refer to something such as less than candid, then I, as an advocate for this man, should have a right to meet that specific charge, if you will, so that I can respond in the context of this heated dispute existing between these parties, between whom no love was lost. More importantly, Your Honors...
You need to sum up, Mr. Channel. You use your time.
Justice Moore, I shall. More importantly, this kind of sanction for this violation is without precedent. Your Honors, it is without precedent, as you note in the cases that we have cited to you, for example, Toledo Bar versus Damage, Savage. We only found two cases involving...
Mr. Channel, we have your brief. You've used your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Case is submitted, then you'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.
All right. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. Open session. All Supreme Court of Ohio. Now stands adjourned.
Thank you.
Don't say that to me. Don't believe that.
Could you call Walter, please?